Good morning, everyone. I'd like to convene the February 2nd, 2016 meeting of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Good morning to everyone. Thank you all for being here. We're going to hear a couple of bills today, we have a couple of announcements. I think I'm going to do the announcements first. This is the Ag Committee, Natural Resources. It is today Groundhog Day.
That's right.
Yes,
that's right.
Punxsutawney Phil,
yes,
failed to see his shadow.
Ew.
It is going to be an early spring this
yes.
year, folks. All right.
All right. That's very good.
Yeah, and with that, I think that Representative Esquivel has another announcement.
Yeah, I would like to make, we're going to be discussing today the 75th anniversary of the American Tree Farm System, and I would like everyone to know that we have a member of our committee that was not only a member of that, and probably the only one in the building, but also on the national board, and that was Representative Krieger.
Oh, congratulations, Vice Chair Krieger. And were you not Tree Farmer of the Year, too? Or
in 93.
Nationwide, not
yeah,
just...
there were 73,000 tree farms had their name in the hat. Somehow mine got pulled, I guess.
Well,
there you go.
Very good. Well, congratulations
somebody
on
has
that.
To win the lottery, Representative Krieger.
The lottery would have been pretty good, wouldn't it?
So, well, I think that just shows the commitment that... our vice chair has to the management of not only his property, but the natural resources of the state. And thank you for that.
Thank you. And the stewardship ethic that you want to pass down from generation to generation is done that way, and that's through the family tree farms.
Cool. Very good. Well, I think we need to adopt the rules so that we can operate as a committee. So with that, hopefully folks have had an opportunity to look them over. We've got a hard copy that was just passed out. They're not unlike the rules that we adopted on the floor yesterday. Before I ask for a motion, are there any questions about the rules before us? Okay. Not seeing any. I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2016.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2016. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Gregory?
Aye.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative McEwen?
Aye.
Representative Whitsett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Vice Chair
McClain?
Aye.
Chair Witt?
Aye. The motion passes and the rules are adopted. Committee members, thank you very much. Appreciate that. With that, we're going to... open a public hearing and possible work session on HCR 208, the American Tree Farm System. Mr. Roper, can you give us a very brief background on this?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Concurrent Resolution 208 would recognize the 75th anniversary of the American Tree Farm System, and it commends groups interested in the wise management of Oregon's forest resources.
Thank you very much. And Senator Roblin, I suspect that you're here on the next bill, but I don't want to ignore your presence if you were here for this one. Thank you. Thank you very much. There's one vote in favor of the bill. Thank you. with that, I'd like to call forward, please. Did I open the, did I gavel this
no.
open? Here, we're gaveled open on this hearing. Thank you very much. And with that, I'd like to call forward, please, Dick Cooter, Mike Barsotti, and Scott Hayes, please. Welcome to our committee this morning. Thank you very much. Please determine among yourselves the order of your presentations and proceed.
Thank you. Are we on?
You're on.
Good morning, Chair Witt, and good morning. Vice Chair McLean and Vice Chair Krieger. I am Dick Corder. I'm a tree farmer in Columbia County, and I have served as the chair of the board of directors for the Oregon Oregon Tree Farm System a number of years ago. I'd like to, you have in front of you a written testimony that I presented. I'm going to sort of par that down a little bit and not get into a lot of detail, but I will give you a little bit of history about the tree farm program. Kill the thing before it spreads. That was the sentiment in 1941 of the U.S. Forest Service chief and his assistant. They failed. It spread from the west into the south and into the east. The thing was the American tree farm system. So why were the chief and his assistant in the Forest Service against the tree farm program in 1941? They disliked substituting private cooperation with public regulation. They saw the tree farming program as a move to decrease the pressure for federal regulation. But tree farming in 1941 was not a new subject in that debate. What is a crop? Said Gifford Pinchot, the first chief of the Forest Service, in a speech in 1935. Forestry is tree farming, he further stated. So in June 1941, the Weyerhaeuser Tree Farm, Clemens Tree Farm in the state of Washington was designated and dedicated as the number one tree farm in the country. And during that same year, and actually prior to that, the National Lumber Manufacturers Association was actually in the process of putting together a program across the nation to recognize and begin tree farming. The American Forest Products Industries was a subsidiary of that organization, and they really took on the lead to put the program together. That first year in 1942, five states across the country joined the tree farm program. It was Alabama, Arkansas, California, Oregon, and Washington. I would state those in alphabetical order. I don't know which one did first. Let's think Oregon did. Most of those original organizational meetings were actually held in the old Portland Hotel in downtown Portland, which is now the Pioneer Courthouse Square. By 1946, the program had spread across about half of the United States. That early tree farm movement was really primarily aimed at and was participated in mostly by industry, large company holdings. But by 1954, the principles of the American tree farm system were established. Those were the standards that set the criteria for becoming a tree farm. And they remained for many years. They stated that the property must be privately owned, must be managed for the growth and harvest of forest crops, protected adequately from fire, insects, disease, and destructive grazing, but significantly, harvesting practices were to assure prompt restocking with desirable trees. In the West, well, actually, the AFMPI took the leadership in the East for all the states in the East for the program, but in the West, the Industrial Forestry Association, the California Redwoods Association, and the Western Pine Association took the lead in developing the program. The AFMPI was reorganized in 1969, and that reorganization was very traumatic to the tree farm program. Many of the records to that date had been lost. They finally realized that a lot of the re-inspections were way behind schedule. So AFMPI began a massive re-inspection program. At that time, there were really only about 10 states that had continued and kept up with the process. But at that point, there were thousands of foresters across the country that volunteered their time to get the program back in shape. Landowners were required to demonstrate quality forest management. And that emphasis led to the Outstanding Tree Farmer of the Year program. which really became a national program in 1976. By 1981, 52% of the 20,000 certified tree farms across the United States were less than 100 acres, so it really had moved towards the private, non-industrial, private forest landowner by that time. At that time, there was, again, a huge number of foresters. Roughly 10,000 foresters across the country were participating in the program, volunteering their time. The green sign with the diamond, boldly with tree farm on it, became a nationally recognized symbol of private forestry. By 2001, there were roughly 65,000 tree farms certified, recognizing 81 million acres of land, but 26 million of those acres were private lands. The certification program today serves as an international standard. About the year 2000, the program became recognized and accepted by the International Program for the Endorsement of Forest Certification, commonly referred to as PEFC, which is based in Geneva, Switzerland. Today, the ATFS program is, in fact, the largest and oldest program for family-owned woodlands. And there are about 80,000 tree farms, roughly, and 21 million acres in the program. Some of the names that you might recognize, common names that have and still are tree farmers across the country, actress Andy McDowell, my good friend Rolling Stones musician Chuck Lavelle, President Jimmy Carter, actor Andy Griffith, and Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, and I know there's quite a few others that fit that category as well. But the Oregon Tree Farm Committee has been in existence for most of those years since organization. We incorporated ourselves in 1995 and became the Oregon Tree Farm System Incorporated. Shortly thereafter, after recognizing it was difficult to raise funds, the Oregon Tree Farm Memorial Fund was established for the purpose of helping to support board activities. Today, that fund has about $70,000 in its assets, and there's been over $16,000 distributed out to operate the organization. In Oregon, we've recognized state tree farmers of the year since 1966. Originally, the Portland Chamber of Commerce, the Forestry Committee within the Portland Chamber of Commerce, actually spearheaded that competition, and we now have that inside our own organization. The Oregon Small Woodland Association has been very, very active and very, very helpful. They help us select all county winners. Oregon's been very, very, very well recognized with four national winners, Bert and Betty Udell of Linn County, and of course Wayne and Colleen Krieger of Curry County, Ron and Barbara Bentz of Linn County, and Senator Bob and Margaret Kintai of Lane County. All were National Tree Farmers of the Year. The Oregon Tree Farm members have been very, very active also on the national level. They've served on committees such as the National Operating Committee, which effectively serves similarly to a board of directors to the American Tree Farm System, is now called the Woodlands Operating Committee. The other committees which groups have served on from Oregon are the American Forest Foundation Board of Trustees, which is the board that really looks after and guides the tree farm program. Our own Clint Bentz actually chaired that committee at one time, and he was the first tree farmer chair. It's always been an industrial person, but he was the first tree farmer chair. Other committees which our members have served on is the National Public Affairs Committee. Scott Hayes currently chairs that committee. Our members have served on the Education Committee, a Certification Committee. Many of those committees, our members have served in leadership roles. We've also recognized many, many foresters as inspectors of the year across the years. We now have numerous tree farmers across the state that have been at least certified at least 25 years, and we have a large number that's been certified 50 years now. And next week, one of our members, Joe Holmberg, at a meeting in Seattle, will be recognized nationally for his service. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony and all of the great background. Mike, great to see you again.
Great to see you, Chair Witt.
Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Witt and Vice Chair Krieger and McClain's and members of the committee. Representative Krieger is way too humble.
Yes.
He didn't receive and became an honored as our National Tree Farmer of the Year out of a lottery. It was because the way he manages his property. Mm. So lottery had nothing to do with this.
But we have to tease him about it.
Yeah. Well, we have Tree Farmers of the Year, County Tree Farmers of the Year, State Tree Farmers of the Year, and then regional, Western region, other regions, and national, as a way of encouraging other landowners to manage their lands in a way that benefits all. Well, anyway, my name is Mike Barsotti. I'm a Linn County tree farmer, have a certified tree farm, and I'm a member and past chair of our Oregon Tree Farm Board. This morning, I'd like to talk a bit of why I think the American Tree Farm System and its Oregon chapter is important to Oregon, and why the legislature should recognize it for its 75 years of promoting sustainable forest management. I think we all know that Oregonians appreciate their forests for a wide variety of reasons. The American Tree Farm System is a program that promotes many of these values. And like most of of our work in forestry, understanding of what a sustainable, healthy forest is has evolved over the 75 years. Tree Farm was originally an industrial program to encourage other industrial owners to replant their forest. It then migrated into, evolved into an industrial program to encourage family forest landowners to manage their lands. And then now, as Dick mentioned, when Clint Bentz became the first chair of the National Operating Committee, it became a family-run organization to promote good forestry to other family forest landowners. I'd like to highlight three areas where I think Tree Farm has been really important. One, forest certification. Two, it's a voluntary approach. And three, the significance that having managed lands does for all of Oregonians. Tree Farm is the oldest certification program in the United States. And what that means has evolved. It is now has a set of standards that internationally are recognized. It pays a third-party auditor to come and verify that the landowners are following those standards. Those standards include developing of a intelligent management plan, following the laws, reforestation, addressing air, water, and soil protection, fish, wildlife, and biodiversity, forest health, aesthetics, and timber harvest. These tree farm signs that you see, those green and white diamonds that you see on in our rural lands on fence posts and on gates, signify that those lands behind those signs are being well managed for a wide variety of reasons. The American Tree Farm System is a voluntary approach. In the Oregon Board of Forestry's strategic plan, the Forest Program for Oregon, it states one of its goals is to have landowners voluntarily investing in their property. While it's a voluntary program, it addresses all the components of our regulatory program, the Oregon Forest Practices Act. Landowners develop a strategy in their management plan that meets and fits their goals and objectives, and it does so in a way that meets the standards of sustainability as defined in the program. The landowners receive free professional advice from foresters that represent all sectors of the forest community, from industry, from consultants, and from federal and state agencies. Why is Tree Farm significant? Well-managed lands provide a variety of values and services. They provide jobs, revenue to local communities, and a wide array of wildlife, water quality, fish habitat, and other values that well-managed forests provide. Our tree farmers in Oregon make up 19% of our family forest landowner lands, and our family forest landowners own about 44% of the privately held lands in Oregon. So in conclusion, I ask that you support this House Concurrent Resolution 208 that recognizes the American tree farm system and the role it's played in the last 75 years here in Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you this morning.
Thank you very much, Mike. Yeah. Scott, welcome this morning.
Thank you.
Great to see you.
Chairman, thank you. My name is Scott Hayes. I have a tree farm with my wife, and I have a tree farm in Washington County. I've been certified, and I'm currently the chair of the Oregon tree farm system. You heard about, well, first of all, I'll break it up. Wayne, Representative Cleaver, is a tree farm member, and he has his sign, so each of you are honorary members now of the tree farm system.
All right.
That's your little sign. Now, to be certified, you're going to have to plant at least one tree this spring. So,
you can do that, huh?
That sounds fair.
You can do that.
You know, the American tree farm system, Mike and Dick just told about the history of the past. Talk briefly about where we're going in the future. American Forest Foundation is the organization umbrella, and there's a board of trustees that guides the American tree farm system. One thing we've realized, and the board realized over the last 75 years, we've done a good job helping about 80,000 family woodland owners in America, and about 1,200 families. But there's over 140,000 family woodland owners in Oregon. That's less than 1% nationally, and less than 1% in Oregon. So what the new direction we're going nationally and in Oregon, I think, is we'll still keep the one-on-one forester helping families get good management plans, manage their lands. But we're looking more towards the collaboratives, and I think the last legislative session you passed.
I understand $5 million to go into collaboratives, and the American Tree Farm System, actually, with AFF, they put a report out on 11 Western states, and it's online, and you can read it. Basically, they looked at all the data in 11 Western states and tied wildfire to water. And it's the water, and that's the key. We think we can, with collaboration, attract more landowners to get involved, to manage their lands correctly. And it's about wildfire and water, not only on federal lands, but it's on private lands. In Oregon, almost half of private forest lands are in critical watersheds. So we think through collaboratives, and actually we have a success story right now in east face of the Elkhorns. There's a great project going over there. Willow Resources, Oregon Department of Forestry, OFRI, Oregon Small Woodland Association, Oregon Tree Farm, and a lot of NRCS, a lot of organizations coming together, conservation groups, and we're trying to build those collaborations with the private landowner and the federal agencies and industrial landowners to figure out how you can address the wildfire issue, the defensible space, and get folks, private landowners, to manage their lands. So that's where we're going to be going in Oregon and nationally. And so hopefully you're supporting this resolution as the jump start for the next 75 years where we can get more landowners with tree farm signs on their gates. And their so I appreciate your time. And any questions, we'd be happy to answer.
Thank you very, very much. Representative Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. One is I've gotten a chance to spend some time talking with folks in the East on collaborative work. That's really pretty extraordinary, and it shows quite a bit. The concern that I have seen is the lack of information about the impact of those fires on those tree farmers, the small tree farmers. We see a lot of media that shows, you know, flying over the fire or whatever, but not making it clear that a lot of those fires are wiping out families, tree farmers, especially the Southern Oregon, was it the Gulch Fire?
Gulch Fire, yes.
Down in your neck of the woods there. One of the things that was so obvious was, it's a patchwork anyway down there, but you could see where it was clearly small tree farmers who were being taken out by this. We need to have a little bit more media specifically about those small tree farmers. If you can, I'm just suggesting that you push that as much as possible, because people will see Weyerhaeuser land and they'll just say, well, you know, that's the only group that's being affected. But in fact, the small tree farmers are really being affected, and their small communities are being affected. So I just encourage you to push that as any time you can with media, so that they know that, you know, we're talking about a range of folks, and the fires have a real impact.
Thank you, Representative.
I don't think I'm going to be able to really put one of these up necessarily. I may put one tree in, but I don't think anybody's going to buy it.
It was on. I might comment, Representative Frederick. There is a backyard tree farm program in our program, so you can still have that.
I've got enough trees in my backyard right now. Thank you.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think to follow up on what Representative Frederick said, it's very obvious that when we talk about, if we talk about forest issues at all, we usually focus, so outside of the fires, we focus on federal lands. And we lose sight of the fact that we have all of these private entities, and especially in the northwest corner of the state, we also have state forests. Which I was just having an interesting conversation with. And it strikes me that in the state forest system and in what you've described here, you are truly in the spirit of Pinchot and the conservation idea, which is wise use, not no use, but wise use. And so I applaud your efforts in that area.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Esker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm refreshed to hear that we approach this as a crop. It's a farm. It's a farming situation. And unfortunately, we can't seem to get that through our federal government's head. But, you know, it is. And I've always thought, if you took the last 120 years of logs that have been logged, forest, and you started working it like a crop, you eventually would end up harvesting nothing but old growth after 120 years, and it would be perpetual. But you can't seem to get that to click with people. So thank you for giving it a try.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you all recall the devastating fires we've had in recent years.
Oh, yeah.
And you saw the thing over in Malheur County and some of the things that happened over there. But be aware that if any one of these tree farmers during any type of a slash activity, scribe burn, any of these things you do that we're trying to get the federal government to do or won't, if that fire gets onto the federal land, they can sue you for everything you've got, even if it burns nothing but grass.
But not vice versa.
But turn it around. They don't fight fires. They don't do the things they're supposed to do. And the most common management underneath the Forest Practices Plan, they do none of it. Yet, when we're damaged, private industry, whether it be a Weyerhaeuser or somebody else, or a small woodland owner, you can't come back against the federal government for their mismanagement. The fact that they started a fire or allowed a fire to get out of control and come onto private land, and that needs to be addressed at the federal level. And the incident that happened in California, I don't know if it was Pacific Redwood or one of them down there, but it was something in the neighborhood of a $120 million fine and 30,000 acres of land they took from the company. It was the biggest theft that I ever heard of, and any attorney that was involved that hung by the neck. I guess I could tell you what I really think.
I was just going to say, yes. Vice Chair,
you really shouldn't be
really
so subtle about this.
It really holds back. I can't imagine, though, doing that to a private company, because it's not the company. Right. They had literally hundreds and hundreds of employees that were dependent on those lands and their ethic of raising redwood. A lot of that went away.
Representative Krieger, wasn't that Sierra Pacific?
It might have been Sierra Pacific. Well,
I think it was too. Representative Whitsitt.
Yes, thank you. Being from the east side, the most prolific tree that we have, of course, is juniper over there. And I was wondering if, I know it doesn't fit with tree farms, but if there is any consideration, you know, if you're promoting the use of juniper or, I mean, you look at our farms and they look like tree farms, you know, I mean, you look, we have 40 acres and it's trees, but it's juniper trees. And so I was just wondering if your organization does anything regarding juniper.
I might help you out on if you have the opportunity in June, the Oregon Small Woodland Association is having a meeting in Baker, and that subject is, at least currently, is on the schedule to talk about. So if you have an opportunity, please join us.
Thank you.
You know, one of the issues with the collaboratives in doing restoration for fire is when you do the thinning, what do you do with the product? And certainly juniper is an issue. And I noticed at Par Lumber the other day, there were juniper 4x8 garden boards. So there might be markets, but it's a tough,
yeah,
it's a tough thing. And a tree farmer over in the east side, if they have juniper, they can include how to manage or, you know, usually get rid of juniper. So that could be part of their plan.
Chair Witt,
please.
Vice Chair Krieger and McLean and Representative Witzig. The OSU University now is currently doing a study to determine the strength properties of juniper, which will then allow for and encourage more use of it. So that's a step in that direction.
I've always been struck when I've gone to a tree farm, because it seems a universal truth that every tree farmer is so proud of his or her property. It is just amazing. And the amount of time that folks put in to trying to achieve that perfect management model is just incredible. And no matter what tree farm I've been to, whether it's my neighbors, the Vanettas, who I think probably have more elk per acre than I've ever seen any place, or Dick, you mentioned former Senator Kintai. I have never seen anyone so proud. You couldn't talk to the man for 10 minutes without his love of bats coming into the discussion. And he spent endless hours building bat houses and bat habitat, and it was just incredible. And his love for butterflies and on and on and on, and all of the wildlife that he attracts. And of course, if you go down to Vice Chair Krieger's property, the amount and diversity of wildlife that he has there is just absolutely phenomenal. And it's just true every tree farm. And, you know, in order to attract the numbers and the variety of wildlife, something has to be going right in order to be able to maintain those kinds of populations. It's just a tremendous job, and the pride and the commitment to that management is just palpable among all of the tree farm owners.
One more comment.
Vice Chair Krieger.
I believe that everybody on this committee voted for the wildlife food plot bill last session, which allows to have, you know, before you had every acre had to be reforested, and now you got a percentage you can put into wildlife food plots. And if you talk about the 100,000 small woodland owners, if everybody did 1 acre, it's 100,000 acres that would be available for elk, deer, grouse, whatever it might be, turkeys.
Yep. Well, with that, gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. Certainly appreciate your testimony, your support of the resolution, and the very, very fine job you do in assisting tree farmers across the state to do the very best job possible on their lands. Thank you so much. With that, I'd like to call forward, please, Seth Barnes. And is there anyone else that would like to testify this morning on this resolution? Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, For the record, my name is Seth Barnes. I'm with the Oregon Forest and Industries Council. I'm here today in testimony to give testimony in support of the HCR 208 that we've just heard about, the tree farm initiative. So I'd like to take a moment, as this is the first time I have appeared in front of this committee, I'd like to take a moment just to introduce myself. I know many of you are familiar with the Oregon Forest Industries Council, but not likely familiar with me. And so I'd like to introduce myself to you a little bit, if I could, just for a moment. I'm a fairly new addition to the organization. I've been with the OFIC for about a year now. I'm a professional forester on staff with OFIC. My title is the Director of Forest Policy. By way of background, I have a degree in forest management from Oregon State University, go Beavs, and I've pursued a master's degree in public administration from Washington State University. I have experience in virtually every aspect of forest management, from harvest systems to replanting of trees to wildlife wildfire fighting, as well as cruising timber and just all of the different aspects of forestry. I've spent a lot of time in Washington State implementing the Forest Practices Program in that state, so I'm very familiar with state government and implementing those types of programs. My goal at OFIC is to be a trusted resource for policymakers, and so if you guys ever have any questions in terms of forestry, I'd like to be a resource that you think of, and I am available to you. As you've just heard, the American Tree Farm System has been doing great things for the state of Oregon for generations. They've been promoting sound stewardship of our forest resources for decades, and they continue to be a strong voice carrying the message across our state to this day. What you may not know or fully appreciate is the tie between the American Tree Farm System and other certification programs. Many landowners in the state of Oregon voluntarily choose to participate in these third-party certification programs, such as the Tree Farm Association. These programs require landowners to actively participate in ongoing conservation and stewardship measures, as you guys have been talking about so far. This layer of additional requirement on top of an already rigorous set of state and federal laws that need to be complied with in order to conduct forest practices in this state is substantial. The American Tree Farm System offers landowners one of these certifications. In this process, often small forest landowners become educated regarding their forests and learn more about forest planning, cultural resources, soils, insects and disease, harvest systems, that sort of thing. They write management plans that will serve them for years to come. It's a wonderful program, and those that participate truly become better stewards of their forests because of it. Whereas the American Tree Farm System offers the preeminent program for small forest landowners to become certified, the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, or SFI, is the most common form of certification for large landowners. There is a great deal of cooperation between these two programs. For example, the SFI program requires landowners to promote stewardship on non-industrial or small forest lands throughout the state. One way that this occurs is through direct financial contribution from the SFI to the tree farm system. Also, the state administrators for both of these programs sit on each other's boards to share information and cooperate. Indeed, the practice of voluntary participating in third-party certification is alive and well in the state of Oregon. Our state has some of the highest numbers of participating landowners in the country. In fact, in 2015, Oregon had the largest SFI State Implementation Committee in the country. The State Implementation Committee is made up of participating members in SFI and is one measure of the overall program participation in the state. In closing, I'd like to reiterate that we are in support of HCR 208 and the fine work of the American Tree Farm System. 75 years of promoting sound stewardship in Oregon is a worthy accomplishment, and here's to the next 75. Thank you, and I'm available for questions if you have any.
Thank you very much, Seth. Questions or comments? I am very pleased that OFIC and other groups are in such a strong support of the Family Tree Farmers. Thank you for being here today, and thank you. It's great to have you formally introduced here this morning, and we'll look forward to your presence before our committee here throughout the session.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Take care. Is there anyone else at this point that would like to testify on House Concurrent Resolution 208? Seeing none, hearing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on HCR 208, and I'm going to open a work session on HCR 208. Committee members, I think that this is certainly a very admirable project, and I'm not sensing that there would be any problem with us moving this resolution out of the committee here this morning. Any discussion or questions before I recognize Vice Chair Krieger? Seeing none, Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair, I move House Concurrent Resolution 208 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves HCR 208 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. That's what I thought, yeah. And procedurally here, folks, I need to make a small a correction because it is a resolution. The motion is a motion, rather. Thank you very much. So, again, Vice Chair Krieger moves a HCR to the floor, HCR 208 to the floor with a do adopt motion. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, hearing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the resolution is sent to the floor unanimously. Committee members, thank you very much for your support on that. I'm going to close the work session on HCR 208. And if you'll bear with me. Oh, we need a carrier, don't we?
Yeah, I would recommend Representative Krieger.
Well, I need to reopen the work session on HCR 208, and by unanimous draft, Vice Chair Krieger will be the carrier on this resolution. Thank you, committee members. Close the work session on House HCR 208. And if you'll bear with me just for a second here while I shift a few papers. Okay. Going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4046.
Okay. Very good. Get bitter.
I'd like to call up, please, Senator Roblin with your accomplices.
Yep. Partner in crime.
And Mr. Roper, would you give us a brief background on this bill?
Sure, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 4046 increases the penalties for the unlawful taking or killing of certain wildlife species. It requires revocation of all license, tags, and permits issued pursuant to the wildlife laws for certain offenses, prohibits a person from applying for or obtaining licenses, tags, or permits if such license, tag, or permit is revoked for the second time in a 10-year period. It would require a court to order seizure or forfeiture of guns, boats, vehicles, and other implements used in committing the offense upon a third conviction within a 10-year period, and it expands provisions relating to the unlawful removal of wildlife parts. And we also have two amendments. They're both on OLIS for this bill.
Thank you very, very much. And I would note that there are a lot of people that have done a lot of work to bring this bill forward. This is not the first time around on this bill, and needless to say, on a bill that is both important to those who are trying to stop the poaching of our state's natural resources, along with those folks who are very concerned that we handle those matters in a very judicious manner. It has been challenging at times to bring agreement and consensus. And I think the tremendous work that has been done by so many has made that possible. And I want to thank everyone, not only our colleagues who are before us, but all the good folks from the general public who have come forward and given their personal time and the resources of the groups that they represent in making this bill possible. Thank you all so very much. Colleagues, gentlemen, welcome.
Good Chair Witt, committee members, for the record, Wayne Krieger, State Rep District 1. House Bill 4046 came about as a result of House Bill 2537 from last session, 2015. And House Bill 2537 contained a mandatory requirement for civil action to recover the value of wildlife, and that caused some problems possibly for the Department of Fish and Wildlife and a process where they'd have to be tracking all these violations and then actually maybe going to court in order to enforce them. We felt there was probably going to be a better way of doing that. We were also concerned that it didn't adequately address severe and multiple violations. House Bill 4046 does increase the civil value of wildlife. And one of the bigger examples was the original bill had a $25,000 civil value for moose, goats, and sheep. And those are all located pretty much up in northeast Oregon. I think some of the goats are in a couple other places. But you have to understand that nobody accidentally goes out and takes one of these animals. It's a mental state of intent. And normally for a gain, financial gain, I wouldn't be surprised if we could track it back that there was actually many cases where these were either guided hunts or someone was paid for knowing where the animal was and took someone in. Also, these types of animals, when they go to auction at a safari club or Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation banquet, often those tags go for over $50,000, and I think the Rocky Mountain Elk one went for $140,000 a few years back. So this was an...
Vice Chair Krieger, if you'd excuse me just for a moment. Rep Helm, come on up, please, sir. I don't know, blind spot here or whatever. I looked right past you, sir. I apologize. One of the prime movers of this bill, and my apologies for overlooking you in the audience.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome.
Chair, when I tried looking past him also, but he was in my office all the time. Eating his cake. I think we both learned something about working with one another with this particular bill. We tried to include suggestions from Representative Helms specifically on bear and cougar, and I believe we will have another amendment coming that deals with wolves, possibly. Joe Rowletter's working with the Department of Fish and Wildlife on that. Just real quick on the Dash 1 amendment, it tries to deal with the issues of someone who has a license suspension and then during that suspension goes ahead and goes out and does it again. So if they did have a suspension and think they could make a large amount of money either selling parts or doing something else, it requires a 180 days in the county jail, mandatory. So that's going to give them something to think about. Now, how often are we going to be dealing with it? If you go back to 2011, we increased the penalties on a bull elk with 6 points or more and sturgeon eggs and all those things. I do not know of any cases that were prosecuted after 2011 when those penalties went up. So I don't know if it's been a great deterrent by what we did in 2011. We do know, in fact, I have the state police could be coming in. We need to find a way of tracking that. So if those violations happen, the officer who writes the citation has got to fill out a form and have it entered in the computer so they can pull that up real quick. We need that information in the future to see whether or not we were successful. The Dash 2 amendment, what was asked for by the Oregon Hunters Association, and it's I think, a good amendment. Because it says this section does not apply to unintentional taking or killing of wildlife incident to otherwise lawful activity. And we may have Al Elkins up here to explain that. But this is a step, I think, in the right direction. We've got, I think we've got some safeguards in there, and that it doesn't hammer people necessarily the first time. But if you remember, about a year and a half, 2 years ago, there was an incident in Bend where the three large mule deer were killed, and the guy only took the horns.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He should never be out there again, ever.
That's right.
And this would be an opportunity to make sure that type of person isn't out there taking wildlife. And I don't care if he's taking it with a bow or a gun or a spear. We don't need that type of activity out here. They're too valuable, and it does not set up the proper example if we want people to understand that, hey, there is an ethics about how you take care of and utilize wildlife.
For the record, Arne Roblin, State Senator, District 5. Representative Krieger and I were involved in the bill back in 2011 about raising the fines. And I think the whole purpose is to get people right in the face and let them know, don't do this. Most sportsmen and women would not even consider it. And we have a real hunting ethic in the West that, you know, this is one of those things where turning a person in is considered a positive. I mean, if you know somebody's out there doing this, you have a responsibility to the wildlife. You know, we had a situation when I was a kid growing up in Washington, I think it might have been college, where some hunters, I wouldn't call them hunters, some poachers decided that it would be fun to get on these two ridges and wipe out a whole elk herd up in the Olympic Peninsula. It was unbelievable. I mean, there was no intention of taking anything. They just shot them. And those kinds of people need to really be punished. And I think this bill starts giving the authorities the ability to do the things to say, these are not people we want in and around our wildlife and doing the things they do. When this bill was being drafted, the gray wolf was not a game animal. It is now. Actions taken by our state board and others, and that's why there's an amendment out there for that. There's also an amendment, and as a water board member, we hired trappers to go on the water board land and take care of things. Some people got uptight with that, but the reality is they go out and they'll leave the traps for a day or two, sometimes a little longer. And what we want to make sure of is that if people are doing their jobs and they're trying to take care of things and they are licensed to do that, and inadvertently an animal that's on these lists gets taken, they need to have a recourse to show that that was not the intention, they weren't doing it. Because the people we're after are the people that Representative Krieger was talking about, who knowingly, willingly, and premeditatedly are going out and taking wildlife. You know, the part that's always been hard for me in the West, because I grew up in times that were not real affluent, there were people out there who this was the way they got food for the table. And hopefully we're addressing poverty and food for tables, and this isn't the way to do that. So my feeling has always been that, you know, these are a state asset that is pretty remarkable, and we need to make sure that it's protected. We've got a lot of laws out there so that we make sure that we keep the populations healthy and do the things that we need to do. This aids those people in providing the assets that we need to keep our wildlife as healthy as we possibly can, and we have a responsibility to do that. So I encourage it. I think the amendments are really good, and I encourage you to pass this, and we'll see what we can do about getting it over to the Senate. So thank you very much.
Members of the committee, Ken Helm, House District 34, and I'm very pleased to be speaking to you about the bill today. The conversation about this bill has been going on since the beginning of last session, at least for me, and well beyond that for many of you and some of the members of the Senate as well. The only thing that I would like to add in my support for this bill are two comments. One is a clarification of a question that Chair Witt had for me yesterday, and that is how we're ordering the real tough penalties on the habitual offenders, and why, as a last resort, sort of the third strike is we go after all their equipment. Well, instead of having that be a second strike and then a lifetime suspension as your third strike, here's what I learned, and I think we learned as part of the work group, is In talking to the judges out there that prosecute wildlife crimes and the DAs that do the same, they told us that what really gets these bad guys is taking their stuff away. Because they're going to go and poach without a license under the cover of night and in every secretive way that they can. But when you start taking their pickup away, that really gets them where it hurts. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea there, and wanted to clarify that for you. The other thing that I wanted to echo Senator Roblin's comment is, Representative Krieger and I are serving on the ODFW funding task force right now, and that is a huge job as we try to figure out how to fill that budget gap. And one of the things I think that's clear from the beginning is if we're going to treat our fish and wildlife as the valuable public resources that they are and try to invite both our own citizens and others to utilize that resource and to bring money into our state to do it, we have to protect those animals, both for their game and their non-game uses. And one thing we did learn in this process is that we probably are only understanding the tip of the iceberg on the scope of poaching in this state. So we just can't afford to let the bad guys get these animals that ought to be benefiting everyone. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Representative Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You touched on probably one of the main things for me. I worry about the capacity we have to track and to really do something and find out who's doing this. When you spent your time, you know, as I understand it, working on doing this kind of thing down along the coast for quite a while. And you had a person who was clearly concerned about it and continues to be concerned about it, but I'm not sure that we have enough people out there to really do the work. And so that's the concern that I have. We can pass the laws, we can set up as many penalties as possible, and I think you're right, taking their stuff is a key element. But do we have enough folks out there to really to find out who these people are and really get to them? That's the concern that I have on this. So I'm obviously voting for this bill, but or encouraged by this bill, but I just, the capacity is a huge issue.
Chair Witt, Representative Fredericks, chair of this committee, put together a work group on state police, game enforcement, and we're going to have our second or third meeting, and we're taking a look at their efficiency, costs, backgrounds, education, job skills, a whole host of things. I would say there's some room for improvement, awareness. I think we're going to get there. I think it's very important, too, that we develop a tracking system, as I said, so we actually know when we do make these contacts with these bad guys that they'll be able to tell over a period of time whether or not we're making any progress with convictions. Here again, you've got to get the district attorney to file the right charges. So I think we are on our way. I'm going to be meeting with the deputy superintendent and the head of the game division side within the department here in the next week or so. And, you know, we can sit down in my office and have a cup of coffee. Might say things there we might not say in here. You know what I mean. So we have to find ways of taking care of the resource. As to whether or not we have enough game enforcement officers, if you look at the growth of state's total population, the participation hasn't gone up with the percentages. So we have a lack of participation, but those who do participate, especially if you get over on the east side and some of the south side, mm-hmm. there are literally hundreds and hundreds of square miles that a game officer may not get into for months at a time. Mm-hmm. It's just too big. So one of the most important things is the personal relationship between the individual officer and his community, farmers, ranchers, loggers, commercial fishermen. I wouldn't have had a chance to be successful when I went to Curry County in 64. There were 13 mills. Today there's one. There was like 40 logging companies. Today there's probably 7 or 8. But I knew those people. I knew them personally. I made time to contact them, to have coffee with them, and develop a relationship of trust. That's what we got to get him to do, because that officer cannot be everywhere. He's got to have the public and hunters and fishers out there as another set of eyes to help him take care of the resource.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
Just as an aside, on page 2, line 7, each bald eagle, golden eagle, goshawk, osprey, peregrine falcon, or any other raptor listed as a threatened species or an endangered species by the commission, $5,000. And I just want the committee and people listening to think about this for a moment. A typical wind farm in California kills 350 threatened or endangered raptors every single year. And the industry has asked for a 30-year exclusion on the killing of these birds. It was denied recently in California by a federal district judge. But, I mean, I think we need to, I'm supportive of the bill, but I think we need to look around at other things that are also happening in our, you know, United States regarding that what is approved for takings, if you will, of these same animals with absolutely no recourse or nobody pays any fines. It's just, oh, well, they're dead. And so, you know, it just does not seem equitable to me that we allow this to happen on one hand, and on the other hand, you know, it's a $5,000 fine per animal. And it really has nothing to do with the bill, but it's just something that's happening all over the United States where these wind farms are. So, thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Krieger, didn't we in the 70s, weren't we allowed to take people's pickups and guns when they were violating and poaching? That's what I thought. Did we get away from that or something?
Well, I don't know if we got away from it. It's in statute. I think it referred to, I have to think about it, anything used in the violation. I think we're a little more specific now about what those things might all include. But, you know, if you've got a $40,000 or $50,000 diesel pickup, and you've got an ATV behind it, and you've got a $3,000 or $4,000 rifle and gun, and you're out there intentionally doing something, the court decides to take it all because what you did is in the court's eyes is that bad. That word will get out, and it will be a deterrent.
Follow up, please.
Now, on the fines, I see that it was a 6-point or better on bull elk, and it was a 4-point or better on the deer. What about anything below that? What?
Well, it's always the little ones down below that you harvest anyway.
Hey, there you go.
Try some.
Right into that sound.
Walked right into that one.
Right into that one.
Yeah. Okay.
The 9-point that's in my wall.
We'll take note, too, that it was a witness that was challenging one of the committee members.
By the way, I would like to add that obviously the representative can't count because I've seen the elk as well. It's not 9 points. Must be Eastern count. But what are those fines?
It's right. It's 5,000.
On which now? Oh, below?
On below.
It's
well,
covered.
It's underneath a misdemeanor.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm. It's in there.
And $6,250, and it could be, I think, up to 1 year in jail.
Okay, I see they tied those two together.
It's yeah, it's covered.
Okay. Representative Barreto?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I talked to Representative Krieger this morning about my concern with black bear and cougar at $7,500 when there are a lot of people, well, all over the state, that have these things coming into their backyard. I have a friend who had a freezer on his back porch, and he went out there, and a bear had the lid up, eating out of the freezer, you know. And when you see something like that, there is an initial response, you know, to where you go in and get your gun and take care of it. And so I think in situations like this, there should be some caveat in there. And maybe there is in another statute, you know, as far as human interaction. But I guess that I just wanted to say I do have an issue with that. But I haven't researched all the statutes to see what kind of caveat there is in there. So that is a concern of mine.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I was thinking the same thing, Representative Barreto, as I was sitting here running through some scenarios in my mind, but I hearken back to a time down at our family summer home at Agnes when my mother and dad, who were quite elderly, have fruit trees, and every year the bear come in during the harvest season, and they enjoy the figs particularly, which they fight my mother for when she was making a lot of fig jam. And the apples and the pears always suffer when the bear come in because they break the trees. But the night that the bear actually got in on the back porch and was eating a sack of onions in the middle of the night was quite startling to my parents. And so I have the same kind of question that that Representative Barreto does. Is there some sort of an exception when the critter leaves the orchard and actually comes into the house, that there would be some sort of latitude there? I assume that there would be, but I don't know that. So I would like to have that addressed as well.
And maybe a couple of you could work together to find that level of comfort that makes that possible. Representative Esquivel?
I think what we're trying to get to here is the state of mind of the individual. Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about, certain, because there's going to be certain circumstances no matter what that we can't cover everything with a bill. But I think what you're talking about is a state of mind that you intentionally go out and you intentionally poach, which is detrimental not only to the wildlife, but to the people of the state of Oregon. Correct?
Please.
Chair Witt.
Mr. Krieger.
You know, just a minute ago, we had the American Tree Farm people up here. I had Roy Elliker and Jim Myron down in my tree farm to show them what bear damage looked like a good number of years ago. And I've had probably as much damage as a small woodland owner, about $400,000 worth, that will not be available to provide jobs for loggers or guys hauling logs or mill workers, because the bear are peeling those trees sometimes 20, 30, 40 a night. And these trees can be up to 22, 23 inches in diameter. So that's been in place and a problem in Oregon and runs into the hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And at some point, though they have government trappers out there, you can't keep on top of them during just the time when they're actually violating, so to speak, in there doing that amount of damage. I'm sure if you had anything even close to that in downtown Portland happening, that there'd be some really upset people and say, do we need that number of bears?
Mr. Chair, if I might, and Ken Helm for your record, those questions about intent of the person that might have shot an animal are taken care of in Section 2 of the bill. You can see that's existing statute that we haven't sought to change. And there's a lot of talk in there about intentional taking of animals. I think that's where you'll find the answer. Okay. And there should be a safety valve there for you.
Thank you.
One quick question, and it has nothing to do with the bill. It's already existing statute. But the silver gray squirrel, are these the folks that are running around out on the Capitol grounds, or is this a different squirrel? Do we know? I'm just curious.
I believe that these here are just regular squirrels.
Uh-huh.
Silver gray squirrel is kind of more skinny, longer, has much longer gray tail. Got a lot of them down in our country.
Big tails.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have certain counties where they're open year-round because
like
such a problem on people that have nut trees.
Uh huh. Okay. Very good. I do have a more serious question in it. It has to deal with the amendment that imposes the mandatory 6-month sentence. And I have to tell you that as committed as I am to trying to eliminate poaching, and I've worked with all three of you for a number of years now to try and deal with this situation, as much as poaching causes problems for me, the lack of judicial discretion also causes problems for me. And I've had others express similar concerns. And I am just wondering if we could provide for an up to 6 months of incarceration and allow that judicial discretion as the case may warrant. What would your feelings be on that?
Chair Witt, we've discussed that to some degree in my office, different people that have been in there, Jill Rowletter, Alchemist, and others. We were looking for a way to take the real outrageous cases, and there are not going to be that many of them, and it would be somebody, before you'd ever get to that, it would be somebody who has shown total disregard for the resource, and the existing laws weren't handling them. In other words, it wasn't enough of a deterrent because they did it again. So at some point, you got to say, okay, if the existing laws don't stop this person from doing this, what's the next step? Are you going to let them continue every year to kill two or three elk or bucks and just take the horns, let the animal waste? Or do you put them in a county jail for 6 months and their vehicles and everything else taken away? That, to me, first of all, I doubt that when you look at the rest of the penalties in here and values of animals, hopefully we'll start slowing the whole thing down. But if you'd ever get to that point, I think you do need something in there to cause that type of deterrent. It's not going to be often, that's obvious. That's one reason I want to have the state police, if they possibly can, is to track these type of violations.
And this is obviously a judgment question, and I recognize that a lot of this isn't black and white, but if we have that egregious poaching where somebody's stripping eggs or somebody's cutting horns off or somebody's killing black bears for gallbladders, or I mean, this really despicable stuff that we've all been working on to try and eliminate, would we not expect most judges to throw the book at the person?
Your Honor, you'll let you be the judge today, I guess.
But all right.
Sure, Witt.
I understand.
I have been in court, or was in court, I should say, for 27 and a half years or so. And there's judges who are very sympathetic to this, and there are judges who aren't. And just like there's district attorneys who prosecute well, and there's district attorneys, a couple of counties don't want to prosecute any game violations. What are they supposed to do? So we do have a problem with both prosecutions and judgments. And so our body looks at, you know, there's some shortcomings over there. We can't dictate to the DAs. We can't dictate to the judges. And this is the only way that if you do get one of these here and you do have a DA who wants to do something to try to prevent future action and be an example to others who might want to do it, I don't know any other way to do it.
All right. Representative McEwen.
Chair Witt, you just hearkened on a memory for me that may put some context on this. We were elk hunting over in the Omnaha drainage a number of years ago, and my husband shot a really nice bull, and it was way out, and we all put our pack boards on and went out to help pack the meat out. And as we were going up into the area where he harvested this animal, two gentlemen were coming out with two really nice racks on their backs, packing out to where their car was, and one of the women that was with us had a chat with them, and we were at a point where they were at their pickup. She got a picture of them, and it had their license plate number in the picture. We went out to pack out our animal, which took half a day. It was a long way out. We got back, when we got up to where they had killed their bulls, they cut the heads off and left. And they weren't gutted. They weren't skinned. They had not taken care of the meat. We ran into a game warden and said, we got the license plate of these guys inadvertently in a photograph, so we sent it to the game warden. They were prosecuted up in a courthouse in Portland. My friend who actually took the pictures appeared with photographs. And the judge was getting ready to dismiss the case when she said, "Excuse me, Your Honor, but I'd like to submit these for evidence." And she gave them to the state, to the police officer, who presented them to the judge, who then proceeded to find them and confiscate their weapons. That would not have happened if she hadn't driven from Coos Bay to Portland to appear.
Yes.
And it was interesting to me to see how that unfolded. So, you know, to Representative Krieger's point, I think in some jurisdictions, it depends on who's sitting on the bench. But I know they confiscated their weapons and their licenses were suspended for a period of time. But, you know, it was wanton waste of game that was just stunning. I mean, there are people over in Wallowa County who could have used that meat, and we would have packed it out for them if they just gutted them. They didn't even do that. So, you know, there's some folks out there who I think need appropriate action taken.
Representative, I have you on speed dial, too. So from now on during elk season, I'll remember this.
Pack some out. I know how to pack meat.
Further questions or comments for this panel? Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is something that anyone that spent any time in the woods has witnessed at one time or other in our life. I mean, I've seen it. We've all seen it. And you've obviously seen it, you know. It's just awful. It's deplorable is what it is. And I think I think this is a good start.
I just thought of one final question here. I want to make absolutely sure the bill talks about making it illegal to remove heads or horns or those sorts of things. And I'm presuming, but I want to make absolutely sure, that when Rep. McEwen is packing out my elk this next time, that she can pack out the head separate from the body, and that is actually legal to do that. Yes?
Oh, yes.
All right.
Thank you for that clarification,
Chairwood. You do get her to do that. I want a photograph.
All right. Very good. Gentlemen, as I said earlier, you have spent just an inordinate amount of time bringing this bill forward. Thank you for your absolutely wonderful work in the interests of fish and game in this state. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And non-game species as well. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Shannon Hearn and Ron Anglin, please. Good morning to both of you. Thank you for being here. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shannon Hearn. I'm the Deputy Director for Fish and Wildlife Programs at Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We come here today to request an amendment to House Bill 4046. We would like the inclusion of gray wolf. I believe Senator Roblin mentioned the status has changed. They were delisted in November. That means that they now fall under the game species, and so we think including them in this bill would be the best place. In addition to that, when they were delisted, the commission asked us to consider increasing the penalties for the illegal take of a wolf in Oregon. So for those two reasons, we'd like that consideration.
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. And I really wanted to address the questions that came up on the taking of bear and cougar. And the protections and the coverage that you're looking for are found in Statute 498.012. That's the damage statute that allows permitless take of bear and cougar that are causing damage or serving as a threat to people and or to property. And so in those kind of circumstances, the land is 100% covered, and there's no concerns.
Thank you very much. Representative McEwen.
Very quickly, thank you. I appreciate that. We don't mind sharing the fruit. Just stay out of the house.
well put. Thank you for bringing that consideration forward with the protection of the wolf. it's almost embarrassing to admit that completely overlooked that consideration up to the point that you have mentioned that. I would ask that you work with the chief sponsors of the bill to make sure that we have that amendment before us when we are intending to work this bill in the very near future. Representative Whitsitt.
Will wolves be considered like cougars and bears then if they're threatening your property or yourself?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, at this point it would take statutory change for that to occur. Wolves are not included in the portion of 498.012 that allows permitless take under those kind of circumstances, so the damage statute itself would have to be modified. The wolf plan as written progressively makes it easier for landowners to take wolves when there's damage and the population has grown, but the permitless take like bear and cougar would require a change to the statute.
Additional questions or comments? Thank you both very, very much. And I appreciate your working with the sponsors on that issue. Next, please. How are we doing for time? Wow. I'd like to call up, please, David Cracky, Bob Reese, and Tom Wolf. Tom stepped out. Okay.
He was here.
My invisible friend.
There you go. Well, you can start. Hopefully they'll catch up here.
Thank you, Chair Witt, Vice Chair Krieger, Vice Chair McLean. Really appreciate the opportunity, committee members. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here this session. As Chair Witt has said, this is the culmination of a lot of hard work, and from my seat, it is truly appreciated. My name is David Cracky. I'm an attorney in Portland. I'm also a member of the International Board of Directors of a conservation organization called Wild Aid. We are primarily involved in reducing the demand for endangered species in Asia in particular, and I have just returned on Friday from a three-week tour of China and Hong Kong, and I'm proud to report that there has been some significant success that we've had in reducing demand over there, particularly for shark fin. The demand since we passed the shark fin ban in 2011 is down by 50% to 70% in China. The Central Committee of their government took notice of that, banned it at all official state functions. In the last few months, we have seen a drop in the price of ivory by half. We are seeing, I had the opportunity to speak with many young people over there, and had was really encouraged by the awareness of the situation. Used to be they thought these products, bear gallbladders, whatever it was, that there was no harm to the animals in when they would appear in these markets, that somehow the tusks fell off, the rhino horns fell off, something like that. They now get it. We have the support of some very high-profile celebrities over there, including Yao Ming, some other musicians. I saw posters and placards, billboards throughout the subway system in Shanghai, in Hefei, in Hong Kong. I'm now currently working with a subcommittee. I don't know if any of you saw, but about 2 weeks ago, Hong Kong is working towards some much more strict laws with regard to enforcement of these endangered species issues. We sometimes think that this is an issue that is overseas, that's happening in Africa. That is unfortunately not the case. Part of the impetus for this bill was the fact that a restaurateur up in Walla Walla was caught in a sting by local police up there trying to buy a bag of 22 bear gallbladders. We had a guy last year at the Eugene Airport who was caught with a number of bear paws. The lion bone, cougar bone, they are now called the, quote, poor man's tiger when it's used in traditional Chinese medicine, and it's just reprehensible. What I am most happy about in this bill, certainly with the increases. Well, and one other thing, Chair Witt, your stories with regard to going out with the ODF and W enforcement officers, particularly with regard to the sturgeon poaching, also really laid some impetus to the fact that this is an ongoing problem in Oregon.
Yes.
We sometimes think of it as a problem in Africa, a problem in Asia. But in fact, what it is happening here, those stories, while incidental perhaps or anecdotal, nonetheless demonstrate that there are forces out there under this cover of invisibility that are acting, I think, with impunity, and I think also kind of doing so because they have previously considered any type of penalty or enforcement measures to be ridiculously small. This changes that equation. I'm an optimist. I know that the forfeiture provisions are going to have an effect. I just know they will. I think that your story, Representative McKeown, are really effective in demonstrating that. As an optimist, though, I know that we still need to maintain this pressure, and that's what this bill does. I hope the committee will support the bill. Representative Krieger, you talked about a stewardship ethic when the tree farmers were up here. That certainly applies to this issue as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Tom.
Welcome. Chair Witt, committee members, for record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I'm here to support HB 4046. And let me tell a quick story. I am primarily a fly fisherman, but I go out and do other things. And a few years ago, I was with a friend, Liz Hamilton, and her husband, and we were fishing in what's referred to as a hog line down by Oregon City, where a string of boats goes across the Willamette River trying to catch spring Chinook. And it was a slow day, but we boated a couple fish. And in the afternoon, something grabbed my bait, and I instantly noticed, being the fine, perceptive angler that I am, that it felt a little heavy to be a salmon. And just about that moment, 30 feet from the boat, out from the water jumps a 10-foot mammoth sturgeon to this day I can still visualize it. Can you imagine a 10-foot fish that weighed several hundred pounds jumping out of the water, and not just jumping partially out of water, all the way out of the water? You know, we realized quickly, my boatmates realized quickly that, you know, that's, you can't keep something. So they, as I was sitting there stunned in my seat, they grabbed the line and yanked and pulled the hook out. And thinking about that, there is chains of people that go out and deliberately harvest white sturgeon, the breeding sizes, and cut out just the eggs. You know, this 1,000-pound, this huge fish, and they cut out just the eggs because caviar brings on the market, depending on whether you market it as American caviar or beluga caviar, anywhere from $100 an ounce to $4,000 an ounce. And it's a huge problem. Right now, the population of sturgeon in white sturgeon in the Columbia River, which is the largest white sturgeon population in the world, is doing fairly well. But what's dropping is the number of breeding sturgeon, the number of the large sizes that have the eggs. And that's a great sign of worry for us. You know, what are we going to do that? And I think one of the things we do, and I'm glad that this bill addresses that, is addresses the taking of sturgeon and salmon eggs. And this is great. And I've got to commend Representative Krieger and Representative Helm and Senator Roblin for working together on a bipartisan bill that addresses one of the major problems facing fish and wildlife in the state and in the world, poaching. Back when my parents were growing up in the Depression, and later when they were a young couple living in Wallowa County, when his dad started teaching and coaching, poaching was, frankly, they wouldn't have survived if some nice people in the community hadn't poached deer and gave it to them, although to the day they died, they hated venison. But that's a different story. But things have changed. poachers are no longer people just trying to provide meat on the table. They are organized gangs of people that go out and harvest deer parts, harvest bear gallbladders, and sell them on markets across the world. This needs to stop, and HB 4046 is a good way to start to stop that. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Bob, great to have you here today. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Witt, Vice Chair Krieger, and McLean. My name is Bob Reese, representing the Association of Northwest Steelheaders, also earning my 20th year as a professional fishing guide in the state of Oregon. House Bill 4046, of course, both our associations support and appreciate the work that's gone into the production of this bill. It's long overdue, updating the penalties that poachers, particularly dealing with those that are hardcore poachers. There's a time when there is a time where poachers just believe that this is a cost of doing business. As their profits shrink because of growing fines, hopefully that mentality exits the community, if you call poachers a community. But this bill also addresses the, as has been testified before, the unintentional violators. As we see populations of hunters and fishers stabilize or decrease over time, we certainly don't want to discourage that from a population of people from participating in this incredible outdoor opportunity. Tom addressed sturgeon, of course. Us as a fishing guide community have sat on the sidelines last year and will again this year without a consumptive sturgeon sturgeon opportunity downstream of the Bonneville Dam, and to see this incredible resource, particularly the brood stock, be poached and their eggs sold away, is there could not be penalties that are severe enough for these people that do this. So one thing that I would ask, and I'm afraid to say I'm not totally immersed in the language of the bill, but we've worked with Representative Krieger on, I'm also a member of the Guide Advisory Committee on interstate violators. I don't know if this bill addresses the fact that you could have poachers in multiple violations for poachers in other states. I think that should also be addressed if it's possible in this bill. Because, you know, something that's intolerant in this state and in other states should have a cumulative effect on people that are obviously problematic in this this type of situation. So, in closing, thank you again for working on this bill. We fully support House Bill 4046 and hope that possibly some language could be adopted if there's a need for it to address out-of-state poachers as well. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Committee members, anything for this panel? David, I had no idea that the demand had apparently dropped so significantly in many of the countries where people are poaching for that end market. And I know that you're familiar with people around the world who are involved in trying to stop this kind of demand. And I don't think we ever get the opportunity to hear the demand side. We're trying to stop the supply side over here. And this dramatic drop-off means that education has been working around the world. I mean, this is the great story. And so if you're aware of folks coming from various Asian nations who have been part of this activity in decreasing the demand, let us know. It would be interesting, I think, to hear from them. So,
Chair Witt, thank you very much. I'll pass that on. I'm well aware of many of those people, have direct contact with them, and it truly is one of the success stories. It's quite frankly a little unexpected. And when we passed the shark fin ban in 2011, and then California passed it shortly after we did, then, like I said, the Central Committee did, there is an awareness. You know, we tended to think that it is built into the culture over there and it'll never change. It's not the case. And with education, with people understanding what the actual true costs of this activity are, they say, like all good people everywhere, wow, I'm not going to support that. And to see these dramatic numbers and also the economic numbers with the price of ivory falling by half. Now we are hearing anecdotal reports, at least, of fishermen in the Indian Ocean not hunting sharks or catching sharks just for the fin. because the price doesn't support it. Once the price doesn't support it, they don't have any incentive to do it, much like with this bill. Once the penalty is such that they are disincentivized from poaching, I hope we'll see the same thing on what we are over here, the supply side.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
Thank you very much.
And I wish Senator Roblin was here to hear this, being from the other house, but it all started here in the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee. So thank you all very, very much. I appreciate your appearance and your dedication to this. I'd like to call up next, please, Scott Beckstead, Joe Rollator, and Al Elkins. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States, here to support House Bill 4046 and urge a yes vote. The Humane Society of the United States considers poaching to be a serious animal welfare problem. Here in Oregon, we have a very active anti-poaching reward program that we work in cooperation with the Oregon State Police. Our concern is that we believe that at least as many animals are illegally poached as legally taken by licensed hunters, and so we think that increased penalties are exactly what is warranted. We would support the amendments to bring wolves on par with cougars and bears, with appropriate limitations as Representative Barreto and Representative McEwen brought up. We would support those amendments, and we'd support 4046 and urge a yes vote. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. We, too, support House Bill 4046. If I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to address Representative Frederick's remarks for just a moment. We share your concerns about what's going on out there. The Oregon Hunters Association does. This work group that we had the pleasure of meeting with representatives from the district attorney's office to share our concerns about what's going on in the court system in relation to fines, and we also had a judge that we had communications with, and so that helped us share our frustration levels. Thanks to Representative Witt and Representative Krieger, we have a separate committee that's ongoing working with OSP during the interim, and poaching and the problem of poaching in Oregon is on the agenda for some time in our future meeting. So we will look at that real hard. We have OSP in the room. We can talk about the problem, the extent of the problem. It's kind of like Jell-O right now. You can try to get your hands on it, but you don't completely get your whole hand on the whole issue. Both of the representatives believe that poaching is a four-letter word, so I think we're on the right track, and I think we're going to make some progress. We are hopeful. Our hearts are dead set against anyone that poaches, and we consider it to be a real big issue in the state of Oregon. So we are thankful for this bill, and we are thankful for the progress we believe will be made this year, thanks to the leadership of these two. So that's where we are right now at this time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very, very much, Joe.
Joe, good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I live in Walport. The diversity of this panel right here will tell you about this issue and how we did it. I've been the guy who goes to the Legislative Council on behalf of the legislators and work back and forth. So I think we started in 2008. And a very eclectic group have worked together to try. First of all, we educated ourselves. We talked to the state police and some others, everybody back and forth about what's the magnitude of this problem? How do you feel about it? And, you know, Scott, me, we work on conservation issues. Al, we've worked on conservation issues for a long time. So when somebody poaches an animal, they're stealing it from the state of Oregon.
That's right.
So this bill's got two parts. It's got a restitution part, and it's got a penalty part. So the restitution part, we all looked at and said, okay, what's restitution? What are these animals worth? Well, as Representative Krieger said, a bighorn sheep tag at Safari International sold for almost $200,000 a couple of years ago. So there's a tremendous value for that.
Yes.
By the same respect, under the existing statute, sage grouse were had a restitution value of $20. Well, sage grouse are now endangered, or they're a candidate for listing. And if somebody goes to Eastern Oregon on somebody's farm where and goes to a breeding site and kills 20 sage grouse, they affect every person in Oregon's ability to make a living, because the more these species start to wink out, the more we have to limit the way that we use the land. And so they're stealing it from you and me and everybody else. So we went through the restitution number. And that now a judge can order restitution, or the Fish and Wildlife Commission can sue for restitution. And these are the maximum amounts. So you keep that in mind when you look at these numbers. And then the second one is the penalties. And, you know, they're just plain people who do this over and over and over again. And it's really, it's criminal. Now, I have the great honor of having been pretty good friends with some game wardens and some judges and some DAs. And I think as those penalties go through the system, we have to rely on the judgment of those people. The enforcement officer has to say, well, is there culpable intent here? Did this guy really go out and plan on killing an elk and leaving two bodies? Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
And then the DA has to say, this is a significant thing for the people in my county, and I'm going to prosecute this. And then the judge has to make the decision, because that's a judge's job. So as we go through this system, as I said, a lot of us have worked on it. If there are errors in here of drafting or things got left out, it's my fault, because as I get older, I remember the hole that I caught the last Chinook in December, but I don't remember the words that we all agreed to in some cases. So I apologize for that. But anyhow, I hope you look at this bill, help us make the incentive more to limit poaching. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Joe. And I'd add to your commentary. It's not only stealing, but I think we could argue that in some instances, maybe a lot of instances, these poachers are doing irreparable harm to the gene pools, because they're after the biggest, the best, the biggest rack, the biggest fish. They're at, you know, the most eggs, and that may disappear. David Krakke talked about the poaching of the sturgeon. That poaching goes on in a very limited area where those sturgeon go to breed. I mean, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. And that's where the breeders go, and that's where the poachers go too. And the same thing is, you know, when folks are taking these huge, magnificent bull elk, and we don't know what the losses due to poaching. We can't manage for X number of royal elk disappearing because we didn't know that they disappeared. And that may, as I say, have irreparable harm to gene pools of species across the state. And so it's even worse sometimes than just the numbers that appear. So we're going to put an end to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One quick thing.
Representative Esquivel.
One quick thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The people that hunt fish and trap in the state of Oregon are the ones that are the biggest conservationists we have in the state, because we care about future. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people that talk the talk don't walk the walk.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Representative Gorsuch.
Well, I fully agree with what Representative Vascovell said. Yes. The other thing we have to remember, too, is that there are already natural pressures out there. And so, for instance, for sturgeon, we know that we have other endangered creatures that are out there munching on those as well. So that also exacerbates this problem. When we have illegal takings, then that makes the natural losses just much worse.
Great. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your statements and your commitment to the natural resources of this state.
Thank you.
Truly thank you. Call forward, please. Our last panel that at least that signed up would be Roger Beyer and Bill Cluding. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like an opportunity? Please. Anyone else? Jim, we can probably, if you pull a chair up alongside, we'll get you squeezed in. We've got 10 minutes. We're looking for very short, concise statements from each of you, and you all represent extremely important constituencies. We want to hear what you have to say. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association and also the Oregon Seed Council. First, I'd like to just speak to the Dash 2 amendments. Hopefully you have those with you. I haven't heard anybody speak to those with those amendments in the bill. I think at least the Oregon Small Woodlands would be fine with the bill. And that Dash 2 just speaks of inadvertent take while other lawful activities. An example would be if you're out boomer trapping, for instance, it's a legal activity trying to protect your tree farm. But at the same time, if you catch something in your trap you didn't intend to, a silver gray squirrel, for instance, or it could be worse than that, some sort of a raptor happens to get in your trap, this would protect that activity with the Dash 2 amendments. So I just urge adoption of the Dash 2 amendments. Mr. Chair, on behalf of the Oregon Seed Council, I'd like to point out one other thing that's in this bill, and I don't know exactly how to get around it, but Section 3 of the bill, subsection 3, no person shall waste any edible portion of any game animal, game bird, game fish, or the pelt of any fur-bearing mammal. That sounds good on its face, but let me give you this scenario. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Department of Fish and Wildlife in Oregon issues take permits for the killing of geese in grass seed fields when they are doing damage. Part of those kill permits are that you have to take and bury the animal. You're not allowed to use it. You're not allowed to consume it. So this person who has taken that animal is wasting the edible portion of a game bird. But their permits require them to do that. Under this bill, as I see it, under Section 2 of the bill, Subsection 12, that creates an increased penalty for the wasting of a game bird, but yet their permit requires them to do that. That seems to be a issue that needs to be dealt with if this is going to be moving forward. That is existing law, that part of ORS 498-042, that the non-waste portion is existing law. Another common practice, and I'm taking my Seed Council hat off for a moment, put on my hunting hat. It's very common practice in game birds to not use the entire bird. You take the best parts of the bird. But it happens in big game hunting, too. Are you required under this statute to eat the cheeks out of a deer and elk? That's an edible portion of the animal. Are you required to eat the organs? Those are edible portions of the animal. I think this is something, if you're going to increase penalties and have this as part of the statute that triggers that increase in penalties, that needs to be looked at and addressed, because not all hunters and fishermen use all parts. It says all. You should not waste any edible portion of a game mammal, game bird, or game fish. That word any, I think, triggers a potential problem for very common practices in the field. So, Mr. Chair, of that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very, very much. And, Roger, I'm assuming that you'd be willing to work with Mr. Roper and others here to achieve that consistency that we're maybe a little short on right now.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate that that volunteerism there. Thank you. Who's next?
Chair Whip, for the record, Bill Cluding. I'm here representing the mill workers in the rural Oregon. with the decline of our game numbers, no matter how hard we work, we're gaining on it, but poaching is a very big-time problem, big time. I like the bill. I like the amounts.
Thanks,
little sideline. Sometimes I wonder myself, after applying for a sheep tag since day one, we're looking at almost 40 years and not getting a sheep tag. I've been within 50 yards of a, four different times of a massive bighorn sheep. I thought, well, I could use temporary insanity and get away with it. But again, I like the bill, so please move the bill forward.
Thank you very, very much, Bill. Appreciate that.
Temporary insanity.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis. I'm with the Oregon Forest and Industries Council. I'm here in large part because of my failure to coordinate with Roger Beyer. I also wanted to speak in favor of the Dash 2 amendments to the bill. Representative Whitsitt, I would say in full disclosure, I think that, those amendments would actually exclude from liability the wind farms you were talking about in the context of the avian mortalities. And I, too, share that concern, but it cuts both ways. That is to say, if this particular statute could be used in those circumstances, then it could also be used for taking a pheasant when you're burning your field, or as Roger mentioned, in the context of trapping or driving through the woods and you strike an otherwise game animal. The Section 2 that's talked about in the bill where it talks about the culpable mental state, even if it's not a culpable mental state, it's still a violation and it's still punishable. It's just that the penalties are less. I think that there's a very good policy argument to be made that this bill and the commission's authority to levy penalties is directed at poachers and people who intend to do it, not those who may incidentally impact protected species.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Meyer, and I'm here representing Native Fish Society. We support the bill, and I just wanted to go on record in support of House Bill 4046. The only question I had, and maybe if you have a little work group that discusses this, you look at the equity of the fines among across species. I have nothing against moose. I don't think ODFW invited them to come. They just swam across the Snake River from Idaho, and $50,000 for moose. Wolves also came from Idaho, and they swam across the river. They weren't invited either, but they're only worth $1,000. So you might look at the equity across species.
Thank you very much. And we're going to, first of all, any questions or comments from the committee? Representative
very
McKeown.
Quickly, Chair Witt, I just want to indicate to Mr. Kluding my sympathy. My family's been putting in for sheep tags for probably 40 years as well, and my next-door neighbor drew one when she was 12.
Okay, because I have a comment.
Okay. Ouch. Gentlemen, I want to thank each and every one of you, not only for your testimony here, but you're here hearing after hearing after hearing, and repeatedly the three of you have critically important comments, and thank you so much for that. And we're going to be getting some folks together for some quick amendments. If you have individual interests in being part of that, please check in with Mr. Roper. The equity, Jim, that you talk about, that may be grounds for you wanting to add your two cents here. But I want to ask that everybody who has mentioned amendments, that would be ODF and W, that would be Roger, and that would be Representatives McKeown and Barreto. If you will, please coordinate this with Mr. Roper. I need to get these amendments immediately, folks. So we gotta get rolling on this. And if you will please, please, please do everything you can to coordinate with that with Mr. Roper, I would be most appreciative. Anything further?
Yes.
Representative McLean.
I wanted to.
Vice Chair McLean.
Okay, I'm just going to make one comment. If you're inviting amendments, I really have a problem with changing the Section 3 that you were talking about as far as using everything. The whole idea is that this is respect and stewardship versus poaching and criminal activity. And those words are important. Maybe every single solitary thing, including the cheek of whatever you said, an elk or a deer, cannot be used. But the purpose in shooting with stewardship and respect is that you think of how to utilize everything as much as possible. If we're talking about, you know, something else, another law, like geese in fields and seeds and all of those types of things, there are other laws that take care of that. They are given permits to do that. And so those will be looked at by LC to make sure that they're not in conflict, two laws in conflict. But I think it's extremely important to remember why this has taken 7 or 8 or 9 years and why we want to do it. And that's because we're trying to make sure that we are taking care of criminal activity and poor use of resources. And if you think you have seen anything, you haven't, on this level, we had hunters going along logging roads shooting into our farm passages, and those they took out 30 sheep one time. They took out some Asiatic white deer. We had over 100 that we raised for close to 35 years on that farm. And they just shot them. They didn't take anything. No meat, no horns, you know, nothing. And so I think this is serious. We're trying to get at bad activities, criminal activities, and people who are poachers and people who are not taking care of resources, property, or anything else that we value. So I hope you will be very careful about weakening that part three, Representative Krieger, because I think the LC will help us make sure that there aren't any conflicting laws.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate that very much. With that, if I'm not seeing anything more, I'm going to dismiss the panel. Anyone else? Last and final call on House Bill 4046. Seeing none, I will make the final comment. This bill has been in the making for too many years. I want this bill out of this committee ASAP. I'm going to need everyone's help to make that possible. Thank you very much. With that, I close the public hearing on 4046. Anything for the good of the order? Seeing none, we stand adjourned. Thank you all very, very much.
Does that mean we can't vote on this? We just have to do it? Does that mean we can't vote on this? We just have to do it?